Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's been beautiful here in Aspen today. Warm, sunny, perfect. Too bad I had to spend the whole day stuck in a nightclub getting ready to do the show. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Live from Belly Up in Aspen, Colorado, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Friday, everybody. It is the 1st of July, and as you can hear, I hope, we're doing something a little bit different today. We have been up in Aspen this week. Yes, we are. We are indeed up in Aspen, Colorado this week for the Ideas Festival, which gave us an idea. Marketplace in the raw, a live audience, their questions, the news of the day, and a conversation or two, including, as we get going, our regular Friday weekly wrap. For that, we've got our New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore, here with us at the Belly Up. It is the music club in town, by the way. Also, Christia Friedland, digital editor for Thomson Reuters. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai. Great to be here.
There you go. I would give them a round of applause myself. That's right. Oh. So we'll start, I guess, with the news from yesterday in Washington, Heidi, about rumors of a debt deal. And my question, to frame it slightly differently, is, yeah, great, we're going to have a debt deal, but is it too late already?
Well, it kind of is. We've called the creditworthiness of the United States into question. We've shown we're willing to play fast and loose with when we're going to pay our debts, how we're going to pay our debts, and from where, for instance, from federal pensions. And that can't serve us well in the future. It makes us look kind of flaky.
Christia?
I mostly disagree. I mean, yes, it does make American politicians look kind of flaky. I'm not sure that's a huge surprise to a lot of people. But there is a huge difference between doing a deal on the debt ceiling and missing the deadline. And if Washington can get its act together and do a deal before the money runs out, that makes a really big difference to the market.
All right, wait a second. So the date we've all been working with has been August the 2nd, right? That is the world explodes date. Read in the paper this morning, oh no, now it's July 22nd, because it takes time to write the laws and get the money moved around. And here we have yet another instance of Washington not really appreciating what the market's looking for, which is some degree of certainty. Heidi?
Well, that's absolutely right. In fact, initially, it was supposed to be back in June, then they moved it to July, then to August, back to July. You couldn't plan a wedding this way, right? It just wouldn't be allowed.
And I think it's partly, Kai, about, and Heidi, about negotiating and negotiation. And I think the White House hasn't been doing a terrific job. And this moving deadlines, you know, we have kids. And one of the rules about being a parent is when you say something, you have to stick with it.
No,
otherwise,
this time,
your kid
I really
knows,
mean it, right?
Right, yeah. Right. If bedtime is movable and, okay, it's 8, but tomorrow it's 9, and, oh, actually it's 7:30, your kids don't believe you. Now, actually, I'm like that with my kids.
That I believe.
But I think, in fact, you should maybe be a little more serious when it comes to the creditworthiness of the United States.
Let's talk about the guy who has been doing a lot of the date moving. His name is Timothy Geithner. He's the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States. A little blurbable in the press yesterday that, okay, once this debt thing is done, I'm going to leave and go away. Now, today, or yesterday afternoon, he came out and said to President Clinton in some forum, I'm going to be in the job for a while. So, Christia, why does it matter, A, that we thought he was leaving, and why does it matter that he's staying?
Well, it matters very much who is Secretary of the Treasury. It's an absolutely crucial job, and it is important who's there. Mm-hmm. I think it wouldn't surprise me very much if Secretary Geithner left sometime this year, certainly before the 2012 election. It's a hard job.
Yeah.
He's taken a real beating, and, you know, Treasury secretaries don't always stay for two terms.
Heidi, thoughts?
Yeah, it's not really going to get a lot better for Tim Geithner. He has been through every massive crisis in the U.S. financial system that's made us question the premises of capitalism, from TARP all the way through the stress tests on the banks and now to this. At some point, he's going to have to call it quits on his legacy. And at least with a win, a relative win, like saying at least we have a debt ceiling vote, he can walk away with some dignity.
And I do want to say about Tim Geithner, who does get quite a beating both in politics and in the press, you know, I think history is going to judge him pretty kindly. And I think that history is going to say the U.S. financial markets, U.S. finance, and global finance sort of teetered on the edge of the abyss in 2008. And Tim Geithner did a pretty great job in keeping it together. That's a major accomplishment.
Does that legacy go, does it hold for former Secretary Paulson and Ben Bernanke as well? Because they were the troika, the three of them.
Yeah, I think it does.
Yeah.
I think so, too. I think, you know, history judges us very differently from what we see now. George Washington had an infamously plagued presidency where a lot of people thought he was a complete mess. And obviously, that's not the case now.
Right.
I'm not saying Hank Paulson is like George Washington, but not at all, actually. but it's true that we can't predict what will happen in the future. And very often, in history, the means justify the ends.
All right. Very quickly, I want to touch on the International Monetary Fund, and what it said about us this week was, in essence, get your house in order. But I'm mentioning that only to get to this news out of New York last night and today about Dominique Strauss-Kahn and the IMF and that whole episode. Christy, you have some thoughts?
Yeah. So the news is that it's looking pretty possible that the case against him collapses or is very, very significantly weakened. And if that happens, I think that the press, the New York prosecutors, really owe a big apology to Dominique Strauss-Kahn, because I think there was a real prejudging going on, and the whole tenor of the public discussion was he was guilty. That presumption of innocence just wasn't there. And if the case collapses, we're all going to have a lot of egg on our faces.
Right.
Well, I would actually say, he had a kind of unsavory reputation known within the World Bank beforehand that was twisted in a bigger way.
Right. All right, fair enough. Well, that one, we're just going to have to see how that one plays out. We're going to have to leave that there because it's a lot of
just one sentence. There's a difference there's a difference between being a rapist and being a guy who seduces women, and that's where we confuse things.
And it is also where we leave that topic. We're going to go to audience questions. And in the back of the room, sir, your name, please, and what you want to know.
Sure, Bill Siegel from Winter Park, Florida. All the data points I have seen over the last month have been just dismal. Everything missing on the low side, consumer confidence, purchasing ad nauseum. The economy sputters along, yet this week the stock market has a tremendous rally. Mm-hmm. Why?
Christy, that's for you and your idea you have of the two-speed economy. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I think that this is the new normal. I think America is living in a two-speed, two-tier economy where companies and individuals that are participating in the global economy and, you know, more than half of the S&P 500 companies now get more than half of their profits overseas. Those companies are doing great. There is actually a global boom going on right now. The problem is U.S.-based companies and people who are doing jobs that are not part of the tradable sector are really, really struggling. And I don't see a lot of, you know, shoots of hope in that part of the economy.
Heidi, your thoughts on that disconnect, right? Because it's there.
Right, absolutely. The ex-Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan, was speaking earlier today saying that he believes that the economy will heal itself.
Wait, say that again.
Yeah, I know. It is the unicorns and Care Bears argument.
Say it again. I want to make sure people heard that.
Alan Greenspan said that the U.S. economy may well heal itself and that markets have healed themselves historically. It really does not look that way because everything we've heard this week is we have to do something. We have to do something about education, about the environment, about infrastructure, everything, all of these messes before we slip further. The markets, however, do function on unicorns and Care Bears for the most part. They are a hugely psychological construct, and they do see the U.S. as a relatively safe haven right now compared to the rest of the world. We're seeing some of those benefits, but it fluctuates day by day. You can't read the economy that way.
All right, one more in the back of the room. Wherever the microphone went through. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Kathleen Ricker from Colorado Springs, Colorado. And my question is, based on your experience of talking to people and hopefully having your ear to the ground, do you think that the general public really understands and appreciates how serious this debt default ceiling issue is? Or do you think they just think it's a Republican power play, or they just don't care?
Interesting question. Christy, again, you go first.
Yeah, I don't think that there is huge sort of mass concern about the debt ceiling per se, and I think that that's partly because there are actually genuine differences of opinion. I mean, there is a significant group within the Republican Party that has been arguing that it will actually be okay, and that, you know, that it would maybe even be a good, healthy shock to the system.
Heidi?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very hard to envision a financial apocalypse, whether you're a citizen or an official. I mean, in the days of TARP, before TARP, it was coming down to the point where people weren't going to be able to pull money out of ATMs, and Congress still wouldn't approve that stimulus package. It's very difficult to describe specifically what will happen, and we're all subject to that.
So let me go back to a panel that you and I were on last night, Christy, in which I said, in essence, I can't take another debt limit story. I can't take another Greek debt story. I can't take another banking regulation story. I stop listening, right? How do you get people to listen to these things that are so fundamentally important?
I guess we have to be good, creative journalists.
Yeah, and, but give me a better answer. Come
on. No, seriously. So I guess we have to do two things. One is find ways to connect what's going on to people's lives. Yeah. So, you know, it's not hard to make someone who runs a hedge fund be interested in the Greek sovereign debt crisis.
Right.
They are extremely interested because it has a real impact on their lives. So connect to people's lives. And then the other thing is maybe we should be doing a better job of what Heidi said. You know, it is hard to imagine a financial apocalypse, so maybe we have to do a little bit of scenario planning and you know, say, okay, these are the different scenarios. No one knows for sure, but experts say it could be this, this, or this. Make it real.
Heidi, weigh in here.
I agree. Faulkner said in his Nobel Prize speech, the only problems worth writing about are those of the human heart in conflict with itself. And that goes for finance as well. In everything that happens in finance, whether it's the Greek debt crisis or unemployment, there's a human aspect, as Chris just said, and people are really experiencing a win or a loss. And I think insofar as we can access that and bring it forward to people, then we're doing a better job. The more we step back, the worse we do.
All right. Speaking of winning and losing, there is that small matter of Wall Street to attend to, even though we're doing things differently today. It is 5 wins in a row for the markets. We will have the details when we do the numbers. We are going to turn now from one valley with multi-million dollar homes, that'd be here, the Roaring Fork Valley, to another, far less picturesque though, but probably just as wealthy. A couple of years ago though, when we started talking to Steve Henn about covering Silicon Valley for us, the place was out of sorts. There were vacant office buildings, unemployment was higher than the national average. Those multi-million dollar homes in really nice neighborhoods were sitting unsold for months and weeks at a time. Today though, 2 years on, Silicon Valley is getting its groove back. Here's Steve.
A few days ago, I drove out of Silicon Valley and over the hills to the Pacific. I was headed to an investment conference at the Ritz-Carlton in Half Moon Bay. The hotel and its two golf courses are perched on cliffs. When it's sunny here, it's gorgeous. And it was sunny, but when I arrived, the crowd is inside. Hundreds of entrepreneurs and investors are swarming dozens of little conference rooms, stacking up one 15-minute meeting after the next. If tech investing in the 90s was a mindless orgy, this is more like thoughtful speed dating, and everyone's pitching.
Oodle provides a local marketplace.
So Odesk is a global employment platform.
Mobile has really changed the game for the retail and media sectors.
VPs from Microsoft and HP and emerging giants like VMware are shopping for little companies to buy. Young venture capitalists are hustling, searching for ideas, courting entrepreneurs, and investment bankers are back, too. On the hunt for companies to take public. Justin Patterson is an e-commerce analyst at Morgan Keegan, which organized the conference.
The honey that lures them, besides the gorgeous San Francisco weather, would be just the excitement around the tech market.
There are three simultaneous investment booms going on right now, in social media, mobile, and in the cloud. So is Silicon Valley back?
One word, yes.
VCs have to fight to get in on the best deals. Bidding wars are breaking out for talent. Chris Thornburg is the founder of Beacon Economics.
You're clearly seeing the sort of high-tech, high-skilled labor force really enjoying what's happening.
There are no lines out the door at Silicon Valley Ferrari yet, but cute three-bedroom homes in Palo Alto are going for $1.6 million and drawing crowds of interested 30-something techies. Still, the good times aren't being widely shared.
They're still suffering. There is no doubt about it. The unemployment rate in San Jose is still quite high. And those kind of lower tech jobs, construction jobs, retail jobs, those really haven't really bounced back at this point in time.
Facebook may go public for $100 billion next year, but it employs just 2,500 people. And startups here are intensely focused on keeping their own headcounts down. For many, the goal is not to hire. Gary Swart is the CEO of Odesk, an online outsourcing network. It's a matchmaker that puts companies in touch with online contractors who write code, design websites, even do legal work.
Yeah, we have 58 employees. We augment our staff with 200 full-time equivalent contractors that come to work for us every day from around the world.
Swartz says launching a Silicon Valley startup has never been easier. Investors are waiting on the sidelines. You can outsource your code to India and get up and running fast and cheap. You don't even need to own powerful computers anymore. You can store your data in servers on the cloud. Swartz says Odesk is doubling in size every year and has almost $20 million in the bank. It also has four contractors for every one employee.
And I wouldn't build a business any other way.
And that's what may ultimately make this tech boom different, if in fact it turns out to be a boom. Even here in Silicon Valley, it may well leave a lot of people behind. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Coming up, what's not to love about energy independence? But first, let's do the numbers. Well, from here, it looked like stocks were on a Rocky Mountain high today. The Dow Industrials climbed 168 points, better than 1.3%, closed at 12,582, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ ascended 42 points, 1.5%, 2816, the number you're looking for. The S&P 500 rose 19 points, not quite 1.5%, wrapped up at 1339. For the week, stocks took the roaring fork, so to speak. Sorry. The Dow added almost 5.5% since Monday. The NASDAQ advanced more than 6%. The S&P's hike of more than 5.5% marked its biggest weekly gain in 2 years. Darden Restaurants served up a heaping helping of quarterly profits. Today they rose 19%. Fattened up shares in the parent company of Olive Garden and Red Lobster by more than 6% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at the 4th of July. Don't bother going to work. The markets are closed. There's nothing to do. Keyword, holiday. Do wear sunblock if you're going to participate in Nude Recreation Week. The fun starts Monday. And a little history. Which president was born on the 4th of July? He was the nation's 30th president. He was from Vermont, and he didn't say a whole lot. President Calvin Coolidge. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. That's APM, and we are live today from Belly Up in Aspen, Colorado. You know, you can't spend a week up in the mountains like we have without thinking about the mountains and the environment, and how to hang on to it. It's a topic that on this broadcast usually falls under the category of sustainability. Today, though, we're going to turn that a little bit sideways and talk about the business of being green. With us to do that are Jim Rogers. He's chairman and CEO of Duke Energy. Lynn Jurich, co-founder and president of Sunrun Solar. They are a solar service provider. Also, Marvin Odom, president of Shell Oil. And Marvin, we're going to start with you and a comment you made yesterday in a panel. You were talking to Joe Nocera from the New York Times, and you said, you know, energy independence, it's a phrase I don't really care for much. So
yeah,
you got a new one?
Well, let me clarify that.
All right.
I think I'm not against energy independence. I just think we need to be realistic about it. So we got our energy from a lot of different places, Canada being one that really stands out as being a friendly country and a good place to get energy from. I think the important thing, though, is energy security, producing as much energy domestically as we can is extremely important for economic reasons and so forth. But the opportunity that there is now to produce more domestic energy is so much greater than we've seen in the last several decades, and I think that's just now coming into to realization.
Interesting. Another quick interesting point from your panel yesterday. You said Shell is going to be producing more natural gas than oil by next year, 2012.
Yeah. Right? So you open this with a sustainability comment. I mean, one of the most important ways that we can impact emissions and the environmental side of this equation is by moving the world to natural gas as opposed to coal and other dirtier sources of power. And so, again, as an oil company, we'll be producing more gas than we will oil.
Jim Rogers, do you care where you get your energy from?
I do care, because at the end of the day, my responsibility is to provide affordable, reliable, clean electricity. And so there is no technology that is perfect to meet the requirements of being both affordable and reliable and clean. So I have to do trade-offs because there's no perfect solution. So we continually look at different alternatives. Gas is obviously has a lower carbon footprint than coal, but coal is cheaper and more abundant, and you get long-term contracts. as a contrast.
Right.
Solar is very important because at the end of the day, the price of solar is going to come down dramatically. And as a consequence of that, that will be an important part of the mix.
Yeah, Lynn Jurich, when is solar prices going to come down? Because help us out here.
Great question. You know, it's already affordable today for about 4 million homeowners.
Okay.
So what we do is we make it as easy to install a PV system as buying your utility electricity.
I'm sorry. Oh, PV, photovoltaic, sorry.
Photovoltaic, thank you. We own and build the system on your rooftop and just sell you the power at a price that's less than what you pay your utility. And that value proposition is available today in 9 states for 4 million homeowners. And as the costs decrease, that market expands pretty drastically.
You're worried about competition, Marvin Owen? Not yet. Got to be soon. Got to be soon, though, right?
Actually, not at all. So let me just paint a long-term picture. There's a lot of short-term issues we're talking about here.
Sure.
But we take a very long-term view in this business. We have to because our investments last decades. So if we look out to the middle of this century, if the world continued to use energy the way it does today, you'd need 3 times as much energy as we provide today. 3 times.
Okay.
So now if you assume exceptional efficiency gains and exceptional renewables growth, you might be twice as much as today. So in our kind of far-reaching boundary, we say, let's say energy demand doubles. Renewable energy can take up 30% of that space, which would be faster growth than we've ever seen in any energy source in history. And we'd still need to have, you know, 60, 70% to be made up by something else.
Jim Rogers, weigh in on that. I mean, how do we get the renewables part of this equation to be more substantive, affordable, and appealing, frankly, right?
Well, I think the important thing is that we have to, there's a lot of different models. Lynn has a model.
Yep.
We have a model in terms of how we deploy and make investments to get solar and wind. But here's the important point. We need to keep all these options on the table because technological developments are occurring in all of them. Price of solar, as I mentioned, is coming down. Prices of wind is changing. New battery technology is coming. A next generation of nuclear plants is on the horizon. More advanced coal plants are on the horizon. Gas plants that are even more efficient than the ones today. So I'm, in a sense, technology agnostic.
Yep.
As long as I can achieve the objectives of affordable, reliable, clean, 24/7, 365 days a year.
Lynn Jurich, are you actually making money at Sunrun Solar?
You know, we're investing in the market growth, so we're doing well enough to attract attention of some pretty sophisticated investors. So we've raised about $600 million to fund this.
That's great. That's a lot of money. Yeah.
So they look into the business model, make sure it's sound before they give you that capital. I think one quick thing that we can do in this country is to eliminate a lot of the red tape associated with renewable development. When you look at installing a solar system in Germany, it's 40% cheaper than in the U.S. And that's not the hardware or the labor. That's purely local variation in the building department, how hard it is to get a permit. And that's something we can remove right away that doesn't cost us any money.
Let me ask you not the regulation question, right, but the consistency question, right? And the fact that what all three of you probably are looking for out of government and policymakers is knowing what the plan is.
Yeah.
Right? How much does variability affect your everyday
life?
I mean,
it's so important. I think you'll hear that from everybody up here. But having some predictable policy regulation system, in order for us to invest the billions is the way we think, because we invest about $30 billion a year. But the world needs to invest about $33 trillion in energy between now and 2035 to keep up. Otherwise,
globally,
people will be without energy. That's global.
Wow.
So these policies make all the difference in the world, and we better get our act together as a country around having an energy policy and consistent policies to implement that.
So our share, Jim Rogers, of that $33 trillion is probably, what, $8, $9, $10 trillion? Where are we going to get the money to do this?
Oh, the money is not the problem. If we have clarity on the policy, companies like ours will raise the capital. Even in this very tough environment, we've been able to raise over $10 billion at about a 5% interest rate with a 12-year term. Money's not the issue. I have the same problem as Marvin. I have to build a power plant, and it's going to last 40 to 60 years. So I have to make a bet on what the policy's going to be in the future. And unfortunately, in Washington, they have a 2-4-6 horizon in terms of the future.
Yep.
And my horizon is much longer. Our country needs to be more long-term and focused. That is a key to being able to get this right.
Lynn George, quickly, is solar in the long-term strategy mode yet, or are you guys still scrapping for survival?
We're getting there. I think, you know, if you look at 4 million homeowners we can hit, if we just get down to that cost in Germany, it would be 12 million. So it's there, it's real. And if you look across the whole world, we shipped enough solar equipment, which would be the equivalent of about 17 nuclear plants last year. So there's scale today.
Lynn Jurich, the co-founder and president of Sunrun Solar, Jim Rogers from Duke Energy, and Marvin Odom from the Shell Oil Company. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, an observation about a week spent thinking, because that, in the final analysis, is what the Ideas Festival is all about. Lots of talking and discussing and questioning as a way to get the problems that we face and the advantages that we have front of mind, which is great, so long as there's some doing, too, right? And with that, we are done. That is Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Friday afternoon from the Belly Up in Aspen, Colorado. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average picked up 168 points, 1.3%. The NASDAQ, 42 points, about 1.5%. The S&P 500, 19 points, 1.4%. Thanks today to the good people here at Belly Up, Kimberly Kooligan and Michael Goldberg. Jay Vatuk played the guitar for us. Thanks also to the Aspen Ideas Festival for their hospitality. And, of course, to our live audience. I am pleased to say, by the way, the bar is now open. Stephen Colon and Bradford Craig engineered our Aspen broadcast this week. Nancy Fargali and Megan Larson produced them. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer, at least for now, of this broadcast is a guy by the name of JJ Yore. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend. We'll see you back in LA on Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.